Sai Ram, dear listeners, this is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, welcoming you to this week's episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth. You're listening to me live from our studios in Prashanthi Nilayam, and as always, let us begin by offering our most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Week after week, we try and explore answers for different doubts, questions and confusions. But there's one doubt we all have been spared of, and that is, does God exist or not? We do not realize how very important that is. People who don't have this clarity will be forever in doubt. Is it worth praying? Is someone listening to us? Is it really necessary to be good? So many such basic questions arise, which we all are spared of. The idea that God exists is a basic reference point for most of our further explorations, isn't it? So we all must be grateful for that doubt being made irrelevant in our lives. Well, I know sometimes the boat might rock, but as Swami would say, if only we were to sit and ruminate about our own experiences, objectively, it will not be difficult to be back on firm ground again. More importantly, the knowledge that Swami has so graciously granted us must reflect in the maturity with which we lead our lives and the balance with which we deal with the various situations in our life. With that thought, let's head to the program for this week. Before we head to the question I have lined up for today, permit me to read a very interesting quote. These are words of Thomas Sass. His name is spelled as S-Z-A-S-Z, if at all you want to look up for that. Thomas Sass. He's an Hungarian-American psychiatrist and psychoanalyst. And these are the words of his that I want to quote today. I quote, "Every act of conscious learning requires the willingness to suffer an injury to one's self-esteem. That is why young children, before they are aware of their own self-importance, learn so easily." End of quote. Oh, isn't that a beautiful quote? I really like that one. If we wish to learn anything, or more importantly, wish to improve ourselves in any way, it must start with the acknowledgement that I don't know or there is something lacking in me. Unless we admit we don't know, we will never make attempts to learn, isn't it? So for any form of conscious learning, we must be able to accept that blow to our self-esteem or self-image to start off with. And as the psychiatrist rightly points out, maybe that's why it's so easy for children to learn. They are not aware of their own self-importance, or rather, they have not yet been infected with self-conceit by elders like us. And that is also the reason why as we grow, we find it so difficult to learn. Same is the case with spiritual wisdom too. The process of acquiring the wisdom is actually easy. The toughest part is to unlearn what we have already learned. That's why the spiritual journey starts with a very fundamental question, who am I? We all have answers to this question, but that's the whole problem. We have cartload of answers to this simple question. To understand who we really are, we must first acknowledge that all the answers that we have for this question is actually wrong. We must admit our ignorance and submit to the Guru, and then the Guru can grant the right learning. That's why it is said we must learn to become childlike. So dear listeners, before we head to the question for the week, permit me to read that quote by the Hungarian-American psychoanalyst Thomas Sass one more time. I quote, "Every act of conscious learning requires the willingness to suffer an injury to one's self-esteem. That is why young children, before they are aware of their own self-importance, learn so easily." All right then, let's head to the question that we have for this week. The question is from a listener who's been sending us questions quite regularly, Sister Purna from Sharjah. Actually, there are a couple of questions that she sent us, but both are related to each other. I'm going to play the question in the voice of our volunteer sister Sumana. We'll listen to the question. I think it's an interesting one. And we'll pray to Swami and try to give an answer to that.
Sai Ram, I have two questions. Firstly, can we differentiate our desire and faith? For example, I do not know if it is my desire or faith that my mother will get cured of her walking disability even when new problems get added to her existing condition. Everybody around me finds me dreaming of something impossible, but when she has some pain or is in suffering, I am not disturbed as others, and I firmly believe that nothing is impossible if Swami wills it. She is very devoted to Swami, and I always feel that Swami is there for her. Is this just a desire, or is it my faith in Swami? Secondly, can we entertain desires that we have for the benefit of others? I sometimes desire that someone else should get the same gifts that I have been blessed with. I don't pray to Swami for my own desires, as all my needs are taken care of by Swami. But I desire for others to have everything that I have been blessed with. Is it good to have such thoughts? Should we try to do something for them, or should we put a ceiling on these desires as well? Thank you.
So that's the question, quite an interesting one. It's on the prayers that we make. What is faith and what is really desire? Are we desirous of an outcome, or is it our faith that a certain outcome is going to happen because of our prayer? And as I said, the two questions are related. We'll come to the second question in time, but I think since both are related, in answering one, we will eventually be answering the other two, as we're going to be seeing. Well, all prayers to start with are some form of seeking something from God, right? Anything that is a form of seeking, I'm sorry, all prayers are not necessarily some form of seeking something from God. Some of us even pray just to have that few moments of silence and communion with Swami. But any prayer that is a form of seeking, any prayer that is made seeking some particular result, I think is a form of desire, isn't it? I think in spirituality, the word desire feels like a bad word, and I think that's why we don't want to call our prayers as desires. But then it is not necessarily so. It's not like every desire that we entertain is really bad in that sense. Yes, we do have to overcome all our desires, and that's the ultimate goal, and that's the ultimate process in spirituality itself. But it is a slow process nevertheless, and certainly the act of prayer itself helps us to reach there, and we'll see how that happens through prayer. Now, coming back to desires, instead of looking at these as desires, let me try and put it this way. As we go through life, there are multiple possibilities in life, right? And at each stage of life, there are multiple possibilities that are available from that point in time or related to some activities that we are doing. Say, for example, when we are at school or when we are going through the process of education, we could end up with a good career, or we could have a lackluster one. Or I may become very well endowed and have a very comfortable life, very comfortable finances, or there's a possibility that I may end up struggling to make my ends meet, right? These are all the possibilities that are right in front of us when we are going through the process of education, or even when we are going through the process of schooling. Let's say we'll consider a more short-term possibility of there is an exam, and when there is an exam, what are the possibilities that are in front of us? I may pass, I may fail, or even if I'm passing, I may just scrape through, or I might comfortably pass, or I might clear with distinction. Right? These are all possibilities that are in front of us. Like this, at every stage, there are multiple outcomes possible in life in whatever we take up. And most often, we prefer some outcomes more than the others. Well, in the case of exams, it's very clear. I mean, I don't think any of us want to fail. Most of us, all of us want to pass, right? So in some cases like that, there are some possibilities which are clearly our favorites. But most often as we go through life, when there are multiple outcomes possible, we will favor certain outcomes more, or we would want some more than the others. So how do we shift the probability of the outcomes that we favor in our, which we like in our favor? The simplest thing is we do it through our action. We do it through karma, right? We do such action that will give us that outcome that we are interested in. So in the case of going through schooling, the student studies hard, the student is supposed to pay attention in class, or when we talk about the career which is available for a person. We talk of a more sustained karma or an appropriate action which is done over a period of time, over many, many years, right? But the basic point is when we have many possibilities in front of us and we favor a few possibilities or one possibility more, we do such action that leads us to getting that outcome that we want, right? So this is the general course in our life. Take for example the problem which is posed by the person who is asking the question itself. The sister who's asked us the question of the mother's health, and I'm sure you're taking her through a medical course and she's being given medical treatment, appropriate medical treatment. So when a person is sick, there is a certain outcome we are looking for, that that person should become completely all right, or the person should get a fair amount of good health at the end of that treatment. And that treatment itself becomes the action that we do to ensure that we get that outcome which we want among the many outcomes that are possible, right? So this is the general pattern in life. This is the general pattern in everything that we undertake in life for achieving something. Of course, the thumb rule is that we must ensure that the outcomes we are seeking are noble and legitimate, and the karma that we perform to tip the possibilities in our favor are also righteous, right? That's basically the definition of dharma itself. I should not be sitting and wishing that something bad happens to someone, right, whom I don't like. Even worse is working towards something bad happening to some people, right? At the same time, I cannot indulge in unrighteous acts, even if the ends that I'm looking for is good, is noble in that sense. So this is probably the basic definition of dharma, and this is actually a short digression from the point that we are talking of. But I'm just saying that this is how we define karma, dharma, and the outcomes that we want. So let's go back to the idea of prayer. Where does prayer fit into this process that we are undergoing in life day in and day out? When we believe that I can do the best of my action, I can do all that is in my abilities, and all of us involved in that particular situation can do the best that we can, put in the best of our resources that are available, but it may still not be sufficient to give me the possibility that I am seeking. Or we acknowledge that there are a number of factors that are beyond our control, right? There are some factors which are within our control and we can work towards that, but there are so many factors that are beyond our control. It is then that we all turn to God, or in other words, we seek God's grace, because that will give us that extra advantage so that we can push the probability of those possibilities that we want and turn it in our favor, right? That's why we turn to God. And Swami would say that, he would say that this is like the, you know, God's grace is like the grace marks that we get from our teachers in our exam, right? When we have done the best we can, we've written the answers, but we are just falling short of clearing that exam, or we are stuck up in a grade where if we get two more marks, we can go to the next grade. So the teacher will look at the paper and say, okay, you know, I can give you this, or you could even go to the teacher and plead, ask her or him to give you a couple of marks as grace marks, and you can, you know, just tip your luck in your favor in that sense, right? So in that sense, we turn to God, where we acknowledge that all that I can do, all that I, which is within my control, is not sufficient to tilt the probability of the possibilities in my favor. So I turn to Swami for His grace so that it can give me that extra advantage, right? But of course, in the course of another answer that I had given, I had mentioned how the nature of Swami's grace actually differs with the nature of our relationship with Swami. That's actually outside the scope of this answer, but maybe in the end, if there is time, I'll repeat what I had mentioned as an answer, but we'll skip that for now. So in that sense, all our prayers are nothing but praying for God to dip the possibilities in our favor. But there's another point that we need to keep in mind. Now, what we seek from God, or what we seek from life in general itself, whatever we desire for, you know, I might seek material wealth, I might seek justice in a certain case, or I might seek health, or I might say that I don't want all of these worldly things, I want only spiritual wisdom, I want jnana. So whatever we seek, be it a regular desire or be it a prayer, when we make a prayer to Swami, whatever we seek, which is essentially our desire, is what defines our nature. It is what who we are. What I seek is who I am, right? That's the basic definition of, you know, if you're seeking worldly benefits, people look at you as a worldly person. If you're after spiritual goals, you're looked at as a spiritual person. The same is the case when we are making prayers to Swami too. And that's why Lord Krishna tells Arjuna in the Gita that there are four types of devotees, the Arthi and Artharthi and the Jignasu, right? He says the Arthi is one who is looking for, welfare, and Artharthi is the one who is asking for wealth, and Jignasu is the one who is seeking for Jnana. So based on what a person is seeking from God, that defines his nature, that defines her nature, right? So that is the basic idea of prayer itself. Prayer is a form of seeking. Any form of seeking is nothing but there are multiple possibilities and we want a certain possibility or a certain set of possibilities in our favor. And that is nothing but a different form of desire. We want something more than we want other things. Or we want something and we don't want something else, and that's what is desire. And any prayer that's a form of seeking is actually a form of desire. Not necessarily a bad thing, but that's what is the nature of that desire. Now, where does faith fit into all of this? Before faith and prayer, probably we'll look at faith even when it comes to the mundane efforts that we do or the actions that we perform. If I'm not convinced that by me putting efforts, I'm going to get the desired outcome that I want, why would I take the trouble of putting that effort in that particular situation, right? If I'm acting and believing that my action is going to give me what I'm seeking, it's only then I'm going to be putting that action into that particular situation, isn't that? So in a sense, faith is far more fundamental, and faith and prayer comes later, but we need that kind of, confidence in the idea that what I am doing will give me the results that I am seeking. Swami would say this, why do people not stick to a righteous path? Why is dharma declining in the world? Swami would say that it's because people's faith in dharma is declining. People are not sure if they do the right thing, they will get the appropriate results. So faith is nothing but confidence that the method that I'm adopting will give me the desired results, right? That's basically what faith is. If not 100% confidence, I should at least have a little bit, maybe it'll give me the results that I'm wanting. If I'm 100% convinced that it is not going to give me the results, then why would I even bother considering doing that work, right? Or consider doing, putting in that action. Now apply this idea of confidence and surety to prayer. What is the concept of faith when it comes to prayer? When we talk of prayer, faith is nothing but the confidence that God can sort out the problem that I'm stuck up in, right? Like in your case, whatever the doctors may say, however bleak the situation might appear, is absolutely nothing that is beyond Swami's abilities, right? It's nothing like, well, till this point Swami can handle, till these many complications come, Swami can handle. But if it goes off to, a multiple organ disorder, Swami can't handle. Or if it is a medical condition related to paralysis, then Swami cannot handle. There's nothing like that. There is no point beyond which Swami cannot come and sort out the things, right? And when you are praying to Swami, and like as you pointed out, however much the doctors might come and give you discouraging news about your mother's health, you always feel that whatever is the situation, if Swami wishes to step in, then he can sort out everything in one point, right? In one moment. That confidence in Swami's ability is actually faith. It might appear like, who doesn't have that confidence in Swami? But actually, many of us, if we are in such situations, if we look at ourselves, if we look at what we're thinking, actually speaking, that faith is lacking or is wanting in many senses. Right? And the very fact that there is no point beyond which God's grace cannot come and rescue us is the reason why we always say this, that living with God is endless hope. And we've seen that with Swami and the kind of miracles that Swami has performed especially in the field of medicine. I mean, we are talking about what amount of medical complications can Swami step in and sort out the thing. But we've seen Swami even stepping in after a person has actually been declared dead and has actually been written off as no more alive, Swami coming and restructuring that person. So there is no point at which you can say that, you know, beyond this, Swami cannot help, right? And that is what Swami would keep saying, even to our students. Swami would often say that builder mind and namakam, Swami would say, that kind of firm faith that Swami can do, right? And when we make a prayer, that faith is absolutely essential. And I don't know, I think I might have narrated this incident where sometimes, you know, when we are speaking to Swami, we use the wrong words. And sometimes when students are telling Swami, they would by mistake say, if Swami does this thing, or, you know, Swami ku veelaithe, in Telugu we say that, if it is possible for Swami, you know, Swami should cure my parents, or cure my mother, or, you know, do this for me. And Swami would be very quick to point out that, and he says, what do you mean by if Swami can? And if that is the amount of faith that you have, then, you know, your prayer becomes quite ineffective, right? So that faith that Swami can do, as you are saying, that, you know, everybody else has given up, but you feel that Swami can still do miracles and Swami can, you know, bring her back to absolute health. Yes, that is indeed, you know, that 100% confidence that come what may, let the doctor say whatever they want, you know, Swami can cure her in a trice. That is indeed your faith in Swami. But the question is, so is this the end of the process? So, you know, in the path of devotion, the absolute faith is considered to be the ultimate thing to have. So if this is faith, then is this the end of the process? Is this the end of the journey? As I mentioned briefly in the beginning, we have to head towards a desireless state. And when I say that any form of prayer which is seeking any possibility over other possibilities is actually an expression of prayer, then even though you are having faith after making the prayer, the very fact that we are making a prayer suggests that there is still a desire. And if there is a desire, we have not yet reached that desireless state. But one thing which happens in this process of making a prayer and seeking something from Swami is many times when we pray for something, we may not have the doubt whether Swami can grant it or not, whether Swami can settle the problem or not, or can sort out the issue or not. But we doubt if we deserve it, right? That's one of the doubts which most of us have. Or more than whether we deserve it or not, sometimes we are, I think, wise enough to think that if Swami thinks that this is not the right thing for me, or maybe Swami thinks that this is not the right thing for me to have at this moment, right? That's a thought which sometimes comes to us. We are wise enough to think that way. When that thought occurs, you know, we feel that, you know, if I'm supposed to get it, if it's good for me, then Swami will give it to me. So that does not mean that our desires are completely gone, but, you know, we will still work for it. Let's say, you know, I'm looking for a certain occurrence in my future. I will work for it. I will put karma relating to that, or which will lead to that. I will also pray hard, but after having made my effort and after having prayed, I'll say, Swami, now it's up to you. You know what is best, right? So in such a case, though we know what we want, though we know that we want one particular outcome more than the others, we acknowledge that maybe our understanding of what is best for us could be flawed, right? We make an acknowledgement that, you know, I am looking at this and saying that if I have this, my life will get will be in the right course. But maybe my understanding is flawed. Maybe I'm too short-sighted to think that this is the right thing for me in this particular lifetime. So we, in that sense, we acknowledge that when Swami gives or when Swami refuses to give, Swami is doing it out of a higher wisdom. So I feel that is actually the next level of faith itself. If we could say that this is faith of one level and that's the faith of another level, where I not only have the faith that Swami can grant what I seek, but I also have the faith that if Swami chooses not to grant my wish, then he must surely have a very good reason for that. So in this stage, though my desire still exists, I tend to be a little detached towards my desires as such, right? More like, you know, I say I want this to happen in my life. So that is a possibility that I want. I work for it. I also pray for it. But if Swami doesn't grant it, that possibility is also acceptable to me. I hope you're getting the drift of what I'm trying to say. I want a certain thing. I'm looking for a certain possibility to happen. And if Swami chooses not to bless me with that because I made a prayer to Swami and Swami can grant it to me if he wishes, then which means that the other possibility of me not having that is what Swami chooses for me, and that is also acceptable to me. So when all outcomes start becoming acceptable, what does that do to me? It makes me slowly lose my attachment to my desires, isn't it? Right? So when all outcomes start becoming acceptable, we begin to let go of our desires slowly. It of course does not happen instantly. As soon as we come to Swami, it does not happen. As soon as we make a prayer, it does not happen. And sometimes some desires are easy to let go. Some other desires are difficult to let go, especially in cases where we are more attached. When it comes to our children, when it comes to our parents, where there is more attachment. I think a couple of weeks back we spoke about how, you know, the idea of separation and attachment, how it is related to each other. So when it comes to cases where we are more attached, it's very difficult to let go of our desires. But a lot of these small desires, and especially worldly desires, we tend to let go of much, much more easily through this process. Where we want it, we work for it, we pray for it. But then we eventually say that, you know, I'm not too sure if this is the right thing for me to have. So let Swami decide, right? So I do whatever I'm supposed to do, but I acknowledge that my understanding may not be as good. And I also acknowledge that Swami's wisdom is definitely something that I can live by. So let Swami decide, right? So finally, we come to a point where there is nothing really to ask. Through this entire journey, which I am saying of, you know, prayer making us lose our grip over our desires, or making us lose our attachment to our desires, it eventually brings us to the point where there is actually nothing to ask. For example, let's say that I'm a poor man and I'm praying to Swami that I want to become rich. So if I start strongly believing that, you know, if Swami answers my prayer, or if Swami chooses not to answer my prayer, both are acceptable to me because I believe that Swami knows what is best for me. So in that case, I want to be rich. I will be happy if I am rich. But right now I am poor, and maybe Swami wants me to be poor, right? If Swami doesn't answer my prayer, I'm going to remain to be poor. And if what Swami chooses is acceptable to me, it means the state in which I am right now is acceptable to me, right? I hope you're understanding where I'm getting. So if I'm looking for something to happen to me in future and I'm praying to Swami for that, and if I believe that Swami chooses that that is not the right thing for me and does not grant that to me, which means the situation I am in right now is acceptable to me, right? I'm talking about future having something, and right now when I'm not having that particular blessing which I'm seeking, right? In other words, there is perfect acceptance of the present. And there is perfect acceptance of every moment that subsequently follows. So when my present state is perfect and I can be in that attitude always, then where is the question of me desiring for anything, right? So that way, I think we will eventually get to the point where we say there is nothing to ask Swami, because Swami knows what is best. And right now he's doing for me what is perfect, what is the best for me. And the next moment too, is actually doing what is best for me, what is perfect for me. So when we talk of faith, as I was saying, the way I look at it, I think there are two distinct steps in this process of having faith in Swami. One is faith in Swami's grace, that Swami can solve any of my problems, however insurmountable they may appear, Swami can solve that problem, right? In other words, it is faith in Swami's omnipotence or his all-powerful abilities, right? But the next level in that faith is the faith in Swami's omniscience, or rather Swami's wisdom, saying that Swami knows what is best and he is doing it to me right now. Right now what is happening in my life is the right thing that needs to be happening to me. Right? So perfect faith is nothing but knowing that whatever is happening right now is the most perfect thing to happen. So the present is perfect as it is. And this attitude we hold on to whatever happens in our life. You know, it's easy to hold on to that when life is in a plateau where nothing up and down is happening. But it becomes more difficult when there are tribulations happening in our life or unpleasant things happening in our life. But when we are able to hold on to this idea through this process, which I said, you know, the first process is we do action trying to achieve what we want. But when we bring Swami into the picture, when we bring God into the equation, we are acknowledging that my actions alone are not enough. And there are so many factors which are beyond my control. So I'm turning to Swami. So we are, in a sense, acknowledging our inabilities. That's why Swami would often say that prayer is meant to make us humble. Because the moment we acknowledge that I'm not powerful enough to achieve whatever I want purely through my actions, we are acknowledging our humility. I mean, we are becoming humble in that process. And the first level of faith, as I said, is we pray to Swami. We believe that Swami can achieve whatever, I mean, Swami can sort out whatever problem I am in. But at the same time, the next level of faith is we say that, you know, Swami, I've done whatever I can. I'm praying to you, but you know what is best. So I'll accept whatever is your will. So when we go to that state, I think eventually we let go of our desires. We become less attached to our desires and finally come to a point where there is nothing really to seek, because we feel that, you know, today I'm a poor man. I'm a poor man because Swami wanted me to remain poor. And Swami has chosen this Swami. It's acceptable for me. So there is nothing to really ask in that sense. Well, the question will come like, what happens to actions after that? Will we stop doing any actions at all? Because as I said, actions are invariably investments that we make to tip possibilities in our favor. I'll come to that. I hopefully will have time to explain that. We'll come to that eventually. But this is what it is. And that's actually an interesting idea that explains why Krishna said that there are four types of devotees, and they are Arthi, Artharthi, Jignasu and Jnani. Right? See, if you're going to categorize devotees based on what they seek, then it should be, you know, the one who is seeking for wealth, one who is seeking for comforts, and one is seeking for knowledge, and one who is not seeking at all. Right? So the fourth category of people should be actually the desireless one. You know, Krishna should have thought of some name which suggests that the fourth category is the desireless devotees. But he gives the label called Jnani, or the wise one or the knowledgeable one. So what is that knowledge that they are characterized by? This knowledge that the present is perfect and I don't need to seek anything more than this. This present is perfect, the next moment is perfect, and every subsequent moment is perfect in itself. There's nothing to seek. That knowledge, the one who is endowed with that knowledge, the one who loves God with that perfect faith, is the one who is a Jnani, right? He does not have even the necessity to seek spiritual wisdom from God. So that is the knowledge that he is endowed with, right? Now, so that's probably the answer to the first question. You know, when we make a prayer to Swami, yes, it is a form of desire, but, you know, we don't have to look at everything as, oh, it's a desire and it's bad. And yes, we have to become desireless, but it's not a switch that we can turn on and we can become desireless. It doesn't happen that way. And that's why this process of prayer itself can get us to that state where we eventually become desireless, where we let go of our desires and we come to a point where we have no necessity for desires at all. Now, coming to the next part of your question, which is about, is it okay to pray for others? I think almost all that I explained about the prayer that we make for something that we want is pretty much applicable to when we think of making a prayer for others, right? But before that, answering that question straight away, is it right or wrong to pray for others? I think it's absolutely right. Of course, it is a good thing that we pray for others. Well, isn't that the reason why Swami makes us chant Samasta Loka Sukhino Bhavantu every time there is a bhajan session, and every day in Prashanti Nilayam we would do that? And when Swami was physically in front of us, when he would chant that, you know, you could make out that Swami would make gestures with his hand which suggest that he's actually accepting that prayer, and, you know, he would bless at that moment when we are chanting in a Loka Samastha earlier or Samastha Loka in the later years. So definitely it is the right thing to do, to be able to pray for everybody else and to pray for all is the right thing to do. There's no doubt about that. And the reason that praying for others is good is what I explained as the first point when I was talking about prayer itself, right? Because what we seek defines who we are, right? And that's what prayer also becomes a very, very good definition of who we are. So if instead of seeking my own happiness, instead of seeking my own welfare, if I have the maturity to seek for others also, well, that does show my broad-heartedness and that does show my selflessness, isn't it? So in that sense, it is definitely the right thing to do, that the ability to pray for everybody else and the pray and, you know, as we often say, that's like the basic idea of goodness itself. What I seek for myself, I seek for others too. So in fact, Swami would in fact encourage this attitude in us especially when we were students. I think just a couple of weeks back, I happened to meet one old student who was from the primary school, and he was narrating this very simple but beautiful incident. And he was saying how Swami inculcated this attitude of thinking of others' welfare and, you know, seeking for everyone, the idea of unity in them when they were small children. I think this must have been when they were in the fourth or fifth standard or something like that, or, you know, some one of those lower classes. And the primary school children were sitting there for Swami's darshan. Swami had gone inside for interview. When he came out, it's a sight that we've all seen, and very, very fond sight. Swami would very casually walk up to the primary school block and Swami would pick up some student and speak something to him. So when Swami went up to the primary school student's block that day, one of the boys got up and, you know, went up to Swami, and very, very clearly and very categorically, he made a prayer to Swami. And, you know, it's almost like he went and demanded from Swami for this prayer that he was making. Very clearly and very in simple words, he went and told Swami, "Swami, today we have a maths exam. It's a very difficult exam. So we want Swami's blessings, you know, and I want Swami's prasadam for my entire class." Right? This is what this boy's, you know, literally like a three-step prayer that he made. He went up to Swami and said, "Swami, there is a maths exam today. The maths exam is very tough. I want prasadam, and I want prasadam for all my brothers in my class." And when he completed this prayer, when he said that I want for everybody in my class, the boys who were there could really see that Swami's face lit up. Swami was so happy that this boy was not praying for himself, but praying for the entire class. So Swami made this little boy, you know, cup his hands. Like when you're receiving some, you know, tirtham or something like that, Swami made him cup his hands like that. And Swami waved his hand and materialized a copious amount of vibhuti, filled his palm, a mound of vibhuti in his palm. And Swami told, "You go around and give all your classmates." And Swami stood there as this boy went around giving all his classmates that vibhuti. So this brother who was sharing this incident to me, you know, he said it was such a powerful message that Swami was giving, that when you are in that state where you not only seek for yourself, but you're seeking for others too. And Swami really encouraged that. Swami said that, you know, that's the right attitude to have, that you should always think of others too. And it's understandable that we are not going to overcome our desires just like that. But as long as we have desires, Swami would say that, you know, you move from I to we, from we to he. I think that's one of the topics that we were speaking about this afternoon as part of the Conversations with Bhagwan book, the satsang we are doing on that book, where Swami makes this clear progress that we are supposed to do. From seeking for ourselves, we think of us as a part of a larger group. And Swami would say that if you wish for the benefit of all, you're also part of society and you will also benefit. There's no way that you're going to be left out when you're going to pray for others. So Swami would always encourage this idea of praying for everybody. But of course, when it came to physically asking Swami, there was another aspect that Swami would warn us about. I think that is also important to keep in our mind. The feeling that I will ask Swami on behalf of others, right? Especially this was a thing when Swami was physically accessible. Because, you know, Swami would sometimes get upset and say, you know, Nuemi messengera, Swami will ask. You know, if you go and ask, "Swami, this person is not well, you know, please Swami do this." sometimes Swami will bless, because many times what would happen is some students would be unwell in the hostel and some students would ask Swami in the bhajan, during darshan, and Swami would give them prasadam to be given to the boy who is sick in the hostel. But sometimes Swami would get a little upset and say, are you a messenger? Why are you coming and asking for others? That is because at some point we might get this idea that I have more access to Swami than others and I am asking on behalf of others, right? And this may happen even in our prayers. Just be conscious of that. I'm just making a mention because this is something that Swami also taught us, especially, you know, when we were students, there were a lot of devotees back home who would think that, you know, students are so close to Swami, students get to interact so much with Swami. So when they want to write a letter to Swami, they would write letters and give it to the students whom they know who are in the hostel, and they would request them to give it to Swami. And so many times, and so many students have shared incidents where, you know, they would hold letters written by others along with the letters that they have written themselves, and Swami would come and pick exactly the letter which the student alone has written and will not take the letters of others. And sometimes Swami will get even upset. Swami would say, Nuvanti Postmaster, you're getting others' letters and delivering it to me. Swami would say that, why are you carrying others' letters? That the reason is Swami always encouraged that idea that you can pray and Swami will listen. You don't need anybody else to pray on your behalf. So that's one thing that we need to keep in our mind in case we feel that, oh, you know, if I pray to Swami, Swami listens, so let me pray for others. If at all that thought happens to crop up in our mind, just be aware that that is something that Swami does not agree. But otherwise, praying for others is definitely the right thing to do, right? The attitude that we wish well for others is absolutely not wrong. We can never say that it is wrong. But just like in when we pray for ourselves, when we pray for others too, we are doing it with the idea that, you know, I know what is best. When I'm praying for myself, and when I say that, Swami, please give me this degree, or Swami, please give me this contract, and this is a job which I'm doing, it is like I'm saying, Swami, I know that this is the right thing for me, so I'm asking you. So when I'm praying for somebody else, I think I'm also saying that, Swami, I know what is best for that person, so I'm asking you. Right? And when we cannot be sure of what is good for us, in spite of us being in that situation and knowing all the aspects of that situation, how can we be sure of someone else's situation, right? And how can we be sure what is right for that person? So I'm not saying that praying for others is wrong, but just like how in prayer we were talking about that graduation where we do what needs to be done, we pray to Swami, and then we say that, Swami, you know what is best. You do what is the right thing for the, you know, that situation. I think same thing holds good even when it comes to we praying for others. Nothing wrong in praying, but always remember that Swami knows what is best and Swami will give what is the right thing at the right time, right? In fact, there's this very, very beautiful incident which Professor Nanjundia would narrate, and I'm sure you must have heard it multiple times on the radio or must have even heard it from him, where once Swami was not talking to some students, something which would happen quite often. Swami would get upset with something the students would have done. So Swami would want to teach them a lesson. So Swami would stop talking to them. Swami would avoid them completely. So this happened one particular time, and there were a group of boys whom Swami was not talking to. And Professor Nanjundia, who was a lecturer at that point in time, these boys came and spoke to him, and they said, sir, you know, we are very, very pained. We don't feel like living. Swami is not talking to us, and there's no point in us continuing this way. And, you know, they just poured out, and they all started crying in front of him, and he was so moved. He said, why is Swami treating these boys like this? So he decided that evening that he'll go and speak to Swami, and, you know, he mentioned these boys' names, and he was trying to tell Swami that, Swami, these boys came and spoke to me. They're so very sad that Swami is not talking to them. You know, please speak to them. And Swami's response was, you know, it really pulled the rug from under his feet. Swami asked him, Nanjundia, do you have more compassion than Swami? He asked Professor Nanjundia, because he said, see, I'm the most compassionate one. And Swami went on to explain, see, my heart is like butter. My heart is so soft. But even for butter to melt, there needs to be a little bit of heat. So Swami is asking him, is it that your heart is even more softer than my heart? That you melt in compassion and you think that Swami is so stone-hearted? Swami is saying that I know what is the right thing, so you don't have to come and ask me for on behalf of others, right? So it's not wrong to seek for others, because as long as we seek for ourselves, it means that our wisdom is not complete. It means that we still have desires. So when we have desires for ourselves, there's nothing wrong in seeking for others. In fact, it would be hypocritical to think that, you know, I know what is best for me, so I'll make my prayers for myself. But when it comes to others, you know, only Swami knows what is good for him or what is good for her. I think that would become a little hypocritical, right? So as long as we have desires for ourselves and we are making prayers to Swami saying that, Swami, I want this because I think this is the right thing for me, there's nothing wrong in praying for others, which is actually just an extension of what we think is right for ourselves, right? So seeking for others is also a form of desire. That's the bottom line that I'm making, right? But if we start with, but we're talking about ceiling on desires, I think one part of the question was that, is seeking something for others is also a desire, and ceiling on desires means that we have to give up such desires also. Yes, it is a form of desire, but you don't have to start ceiling on desires by ceiling such desires, right? Especially when Swami speaks about ceiling on desires, the first set of desires that we need to put a ceiling on are selfish desires, and even among selfish desires, superfluous desires. I think that is what Swami wants us to get rid of first. I already have a car, I want a bigger car. I already have a home, I want a more luxurious home, right? Or things like that. You know, I am perfectly comfortable with what I have, but for no reason we are greedy for more. So Swami would say that start with ceiling on such desires. Ask yourself, if you want something, do I really need that? Can I get on with life without that? Do I really need this object? So ceiling on desires starts with that. You don't have to start ceiling on desires with the noble desires that you have on behalf of others, right? And certainly when it comes to action also, it's the same thing. Just like how when I have a desire, I put action to achieve that possibility which I am fond of achieving. Same is the case when we are seeing someone in trouble. You know, we want to see that person's pain alleviated. I think we have to do the action which will alleviate that person's pain. And that's what Swami refers to as seva, which is the most important message that Swami wants us to follow, right? So in that sense, yes, it is a form of desire, but you certainly don't have to start ceiling on desires from that point. And, you know, you cannot, as I mentioned so many times in the course of this answer already, you cannot wish away desires. You cannot say that having desires is bad, so I'm going to stop having desires. When you say I want to not have desires, that again becomes a desire, right? So it's a paradox in itself. So this has to be sublimated slowly, and eventually you say that there's nothing to seek. Swami knows what is best, and Swami is doing what is best, and Swami is doing it right now, and Swami is going to be doing it every moment after this too. That is the ultimate faith, but it will come slowly, and it will come, you know, only out of love, right? I started off the program by saying that, you know, we are all so fortunate that the idea that God is something that we have started off with. We don't go back to doubting that. In fact, added to that, we also have this feeling that God is, and God loves us too, right? We don't think of God as some superhuman being who's just sitting up in heavens and overlooking things. We also believe that God loves us, and we love God, and God loves us in return, right? And that is why I made a mention that the nature of our relationship with God also decides the nature of His grace. Because when I think of Swami as somebody who can, you know, I've done all that I can do and I want a certain outcome and I go to Swami, it is like I'm bringing in Swami only in the last moment as a contingency plan. Like, I've done whatever I can, but let's ensure that nothing fails. So if you go to God at the last moment like that, you know, His grace will be like, okay, He will look at your past. He will look at, you know, whatever you've done, and do you deserve that particular event happening in your life? So He's going to be like that, probably like the examiner who has no idea of who you are, who's correcting your paper, and who's only going to give you the worth of marks based on what you've written on the paper. But on the other hand, if we look at Swami and say that, Swami, you tell me what to do. You tell me what desires to have. You tell me what is the noble way of leading our life. In that case, you know, you're not making Swami merely an examiner who comes the last moment of your learning process. But he becomes the teacher who is going to teach you what is the action that you have to do too, right? So he influences the actions that we do. He will influence the kind of desires we cultivate within ourselves. So he becomes a part of every process, and his grace will also be different in that sense, right? He will teach us to do the right thing, and he will then judge us, and he will give us the right reward. At that point, that's what Swami had told one of the teachers, right? You know, if you see a student who gets 35 out of 100, and you know that that student needs probably just 5 more marks to pass. If you've been the teacher of that student, you know, seeing this paper, you'll know that, okay, I mean, this boy has actually put in a lot of effort. You know, I can make out that he has pushed himself and he has got to this mark, so I'll give him that grace mark, right? So that is what happens when we not only give Swami the role of the final dispenser of our destiny, but we make him a part of life. And when that happens, even the actions that we perform are guided by him. Even the actions that we do and the desires that we entertain are whetted by what is Swami's likes and dislikes. And eventually, whatever we do is also offered to Swami, right? That's what Swami says. When I start acknowledging that I cannot do anything with my actions which will give me the desired results, will I stop acting? Yes, there is a possibility, but when we bring Swami right into the life, into our lives this manner, then our actions itself will become a form of obedience, right? Right now, if I'm a student, yes, to get that particular mark at the end of the year or to get that particular grade at the end of the course, I study. But when I bring Swami into my life, I start studying as a means of pleasing Swami itself. I say that, Swami, this is the duty I'm supposed to perform. This is the studies I'm supposed to do. I'm doing it as my offering to Swami. That's what Swami would teach us, right? That you do the work itself as a process of worship. So even though you acknowledge that, Swami, the work I'm doing is not going to give me the result, you are the one who's going to give me the result as your grace, but I'm doing the work itself as a process of my worship to you, right? So this is how actually prayer and faith and everything plays in our life. It is not very clear. Sometimes this happens, and I can tell this with personal experience, that we tend to look at what is the most ideal thing and we try to be there, right? Oh, we are not supposed to have desires, or we are not supposed to ask Swami anything, so I will not ask Swami anything. It doesn't happen like that. It has to happen in a very, very smooth and natural manner, right? So in that sense, yes, any form of prayer which we are seeking something from Swami is probably an expression of our desire, but either way, prayer is always good, because as I said, we acknowledge our inability to achieve purely by our own efforts. That makes us humble, and slowly it widens our thinking to accept, you know, multiple possibilities as good. From saying that only this happens, I'll be happy, there are more things which we can be happy with. In fact, that is the process by which we actually become detached towards the outcome. And eventually, it will make us desireless, because we will begin to believe that if I have to get it, Swami will give it to me. Right now, I'm not having it, because right now, it's not right for me to have it. Tomorrow, I might have it. If I have it, then Swami has chosen that that's the right thing for me. So having, not having, failing, succeeding, or being healthy, being unhealthy, being alive, being dead, everything becomes acceptable. And that's when actually our faith becomes perfect. Thank you, sister, for asking that question. I hope I've given a fair amount of understanding into that question, though it was not, I did not try to directly answer that question based on the situation that you've raised. But I hope it gave a little bit of clarity. And thank you for asking that question. If you have anything more to ask, feel free to ask me. So with that, dear listeners, it's time for me to wrap up this week's show of Radio Sai Answering Booth. If you have a question, especially on practical issues that we tend to face in our daily life, and you wanted to be featured on this show, feel free to write to me. I receive questions directly in my mail inbox, and that mail ID is prem@radiosai.org. That's PREM@radiosai.org. That's my personal mail ID. So the mails that you send to me will be read only by me. If you don't wish your name to be revealed on the show, do let me know. I'll not mention it. If you can send your question in your own voice, you can record it. Now, it's so easy to record it. Any smartphone device is good enough to be able to record your voice, and you can send it to me in your voice. It would be wonderful. It's always nice to have a fresh voice on the show. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. I'm going to leave you with a very, very beautiful song, one of my favorite songs. On the other side of it, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of today's Thursday Live, the Vahini Satsang. I'll join you all again next week at 7:30 p.m. for the next episode of Radio Sai Answering Bell.
Korai vondrum illai marai murthi kanna, korai vondrum illai kanna, korai vondrum illai marai murthi kanna, korai vondrum illai kanna. Govinda, kurai vondrum illai marai murthi kanna, kurai vondrum illai kanna, kurai vondrum illai Govinda. Kannukku theriyamal nikkindrai கண்ணுக்கு தெரியாமல் நின்றாலும் எனக்கு குறை ஒன்றும் இல்லை மறைமூர்த்தி கண்ணா வேண்டியதை சொல்திட வெங்கடேஷனிருக்க வேண்டியது வேறில்லை மறைமூர்த்தி கண்ணா மணிவர்ண மலையப்ப கோவில் கண்ணா திரையில் பின்னிக்கின்றாய் கண்ணா உன்னை மறை போது ஞானியர் மட்டுமே காண்பாய் திரையில் பின்னிக்கின்றாய் கண்ணா உன்னை மறை போதும் ஞானியர் மட்டுமே காண்பாய் என்றாலும் குறை ஒன்றும் எனக்கில்லை கண்ணா என்றாலும் குறை ஒன்றும் எனக்கில்லை கண்ணா குன்றின் மேல் கல்லாகி மறைமூர்த்தி கண்ணா குறை ஒன்றும் இல்லை மறைமூர்த்தி கண்ணா மணிவர்ண மலையப்ப கோவிந்த 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 கலி நாளுக்கிறங்கி கல்லிலே நிலையான கோயிலில் நிற்கின்ற கேசவ கலி நாளுக்கிறங்கி கல்லிலே